Welcome, everyone. My name is Glenn Deason, and I'm joined today by Alexander Mercuris and Ian Proud. So Ian Proud is was a member of the British Diplomatic Service from 1999 to 2023. He also served at the British Embassy in Moscow between those important years between 2014 and 19, and recently published his memoirs about, in his words, how British diplomacy in Russia failed during those years. So welcome to the both of you.
Thanks for inviting me.
Great pleasure and delighted to have you in. And I was saying that just before we started the program that I found your book, A Misfit in Moscow, absolutely compelling read, and it kept me up long into the night. It was an absolute page turner and extremely interesting, and it very interesting to see what was going on in the embassy in Moscow and in the Foreign Office during this critical period when we basically took a disastrous turn. And the thought that I had about this, the immediate sense I got from it, is that you were working very hard in Moscow, and I think it's fair to say you weren't entirely alone in trying to work hard in Moscow. There were some people in Moscow who were also trying to do things to build some kind of a dialogue with the Russians, perhaps even a relationship with the Russians. And what was really holding things back more than anything else, this is the sense I got, is a complete lack of interest in London. Occasional flashes, perhaps Boris Johnson interested sometimes, but overall, a sense that London just wasn't engaged in the way that it should have been.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say it's a lack of interest. I think there's been a shift in the UK over the past kind of two decades where ministers and their advisors in Whitehall think they have all the answers. And certainly when Philip Hammond became Foreign Secretary, he had a very clearly hawkish view on Russia. And from that point on, advice and analysis from the embassy in Moscow just wasn't welcomed if it wasn't saying what he wanted to hear. So there was interest, but there wasn't any interest in what the embassy had to say. And I think that's a trend that has very much continued and continues to this day, where I sort of liken the embassy as a Potemkin house in Moscow now with a cardboard cutout ambassador that is there. He's sort of keeping the embassy alive, keeping the basic trappings of diplomacy going, but the ability to influence decision makers, in particular ministers in London, has disappeared. And in fact, it disappeared in 2014 when things really started to get quite difficult in the relationship with Russia.
And the other thing that came across to me, and it was something, by the way, that I sensed at the time, though it went back a little earlier than I realised. I mean, I always felt that when the Germans and the French, together with the Russians, basically came up with Minsk II, that this was a watershed, because we had this agreement about a war in Europe, a major crisis in Europe, and Britain was not a player. We were completely frozen out. And I said at the time, I remember saying this is going to cause trouble, and that the British were, for the first time, I think since the 17th century, essentially excluded from major European diplomacy, and this was going to make problems. Well, I learned two things from your book. Firstly, that the problems actually started earlier than Minsk II. They started the previous year with the Normandy 4 meeting. And secondly, that that was absolutely the awareness in London, and that it caused great bitterness and revulsion, and was one of the things, I perhaps going a bit far now in saying this, but it was one of the things that made us into spoilers in the whole negotiation process in Ukraine. Am I going too far on the last point?
I don't think you are, actually. I think politics in the UK at that time was very distracted. Cameron was very distracted by a number of things. You know, he'd had this kind of successful kind of pitch on Scottish independence that had gone well. And, you know, he wanted to have a punch up with the Europeans over who should be the European Commission president, Jean-Claude Juncker, you know, There's no kind of real support in Europe for that. I mean, that was clearly going to happen, but he invested so much political capital in trying to kind of, leverage kind of Juncker out from that key kind of role in Europe, that he was completely distracted when things were really starting to heat up in terms of the negotiation process on what's happening in Ukraine. And so when Hollande came up with the idea of the Normandy kind of meeting, you know, he was totally distracted by other things. And so that feeling of isolation was self-imposed. You know, I think we could have positioned ourselves within that format at the time, but we didn't. And that was a choice, not a strategic choice, a tactical choice, and one driven by other events. And I think you're right in saying that what that left the UK doing was grasping for a role in the Ukraine crisis. You know, we didn't really have a role in the negotiating process because we're out of the Normandy format. We needed to find another role. Our main role became flag bearer for sanctions and very much kind of getting much more closely aligned with the Americans in terms of their stance on Ukraine, with much less say over what they were doing, in fact.
Did anybody suggest an alternative, that perhaps the way to get into the Normandy fork process was to actually talk to the Russians?
Well, Cameron tried after the fact. In one of my footnotes, you'll notice that there's that time at the ASEM, I think it was, meeting in Milan or in Italy somewhere, where, you know, along Merkel, Poroshenko and Putin were going to meet. And Cameron was very much keen to get in on that meeting. And so they had this kind of rather awkward breakfast, if you recall, with Renzi, Matteo Renzi at the time. But then Cameron was quickly shoved to one side and the Normandy Four went off to a different room to have the actual substantive meeting about the process itself. So, you know, Cameron did want to get back into that, but I think the door was very firmly shut. And it wasn't just shut on the Russian side, it was very much shut, I think, on the French and German sides, because they thought, well, you know, we'll lead on this now, and you, the UK, increasingly distracted by kind of rumblings around sort of possible referenda and so on European membership. You know, there's no place for you now here.
And this then leads... Sorry, go on.
Oh, sorry, you first.
Glenn, I've been talking a lot. You go ahead, Glenn.
Oh, no, I just want to ask, because you mentioned the door was for the British was more or less shut towards the Europeans and the Russians. So Britain then leaning more, again, towards the United States. I was just wondering, during those years, especially when you're in Moscow, what was the main influence of the United States on British policies? Because I guess one of the big things that really stood out in Ukraine after 2014, which hasn't been really reported quite well, is how the extent of American influence over the Ukrainian government, which has been covered by many leading Ukrainians, such as General Prosecutor Viktor Shokin. But I was wondering, what were the main influence of the Americans over British policy, or were they already aligned?
So I'd say three things, probably. The first would be sanctions policy, where, you know, within the EU kind of framework, sanctions is a consensual thing. You know, you agree sanctions, but there's lots of lobbying that goes on in Brussels and in European kind of capitals around what the next tranche should be, whether sanctions should be maintained or dropped. And there's actually, in the first year after sanctions were imposed, there's a lot of pressure from the southern European states in particular, countries like Italy and Spain in particular, heavily agriculturally dependent on Russia, to kind of drop sanctions. And there's a real kind of moment in 2015 when Cyprus went to St. Petersburg. We thought that the sanctions deck of cards could completely collapse. But actually, the UK is really kind of firm in lobbying behind the scenes to kind of maintain the sanctions status quo, which is a fairly lowest common denominator, I have to say, status quo. But nevertheless, it still involved pretty punitive sanctions against Russia. And that was very much kind of, you know, driven in part by the dialogue we're having in parallel with the Americans about, you know, where they're going on the sanctions. Of course, the difference between the European and US sanctions is that when the American sanctions get imposed, that they're there for life, essentially, as we see in Cuba, you know, other countries. But in Europe, they roll over, they have to be re-agreed. And the UK put a lot of effort into ensuring that they were re-agreed and rolled over. And I think after the summer of 2015, after Cyprus's visit, they then became set in stone. That's one, sanctions. Second, on energy policy, this kind of fixation on Nord Stream 2, a lot of pressure from the Americans who themselves, you know, on the back of Obama making it easier for American exporters to export LNG, at a time of kind of the big shale boom in the States. A lot of pressure on us to kind of push back on Russian pipeline projects, not just Nord Stream 2, but South Stream, if you recall. That got nixed after pressure on the Bulgarians, ended up in Turk Stream and so on. And actually this kind of energy conditionality where, you know, pushing back on new pipeline projects, but also insisting that gas continue to be shipped through Ukraine because of the very generous transit revenues that Ukraine got, like $3 billion a year. Even today, Ukraine still earns revenue from transit, much smaller levels, of course, of gas from Russia into the European Union. That would be another. And the third, I say, critically, was about the kind of implementation of the Minsk II agreements and obligations on all the parties. And let's remember that Minsk II was principally about the agreement between, the Ukrainian state and the separatists in the Donbass. I mean, the Russians were there, they signed it, the French and Germans, they signed it. But the agreement was really about how to kind of bring an end to that conflict in the Donbass and have some meaningful way to have a dialogue to kind of de-escalate there through a process of phased devolution and that sort of thing. And of course, there's never really any pressure on the Ukrainians to hold up their end of the bargain on that. I mean, I think Hollande and Merkel briefly had a flap, but sort of trying to kind of press the Ukrainians to kind of hold up or in good faith push forward with their obligations under the Minsk II agreement against a backdrop of very little kind of domestic political support in Ukraine for them to do that. But of course, with the US in particular, and also with the UK, there was no insistence on Ukraine that they kind of, you know, in good faith, hold up their end of the bargain. And that therefore rendered the Minsk II agreement pretty much dead in the water, you know, fairly soon after it was born for that reason. And through that means, because sanctions were critically linked to this idea of full implementation of the Minsk agreements, sanctions also became set in stone against Russia.
Was this deliberate, though, sabotaging Minsk II, if you will, or not pressuring Kiev to uphold its obligations and at the same time train and arm the Ukrainian army? So, you know, preserve the sanctions against Russia and make, you know, Ukraine further cemented in the Western camp, if you will. Was this like a logic behind it, or was it just
too
a way
far to suggest that it was deliberate? I don't think anybody really thought at that kind of strategic level to kind of come up with this grand plan that it should map out that way. I think it's more about kind of laziness and a determination for Ukraine to come out on the right side of this conflict and for us to support them, for, you know, in these kind of hackneyed phrases these days, for as long as it takes, you know, in their kind of difficult relationship with Russia. So I think very little throughout this whole kind of decade has been deliberate or strategic. I think we've kind of lazily wandered into these two sets of relationships. One, how we engage with the Ukrainian state, where, you know, very permissive, not wanting to press them to do things that they don't want to do, and very punitive against Russia, where we see sanctions in the absence of our willingness to actually fight a war in Ukraine. We've seen sanctions as the main kind of tool to kind of affect Russian behavior, and that clearly hasn't worked.
Can I ask why? Why didn't the sanctions work? Because this, I guess, have been one of the main surprises. Not just the sanctions after 2022, but preceding those years as well.
So there are a number of reasons why sanctions haven't worked. The first, certainly, you know, the US sanctions. The US didn't really have as deep an economic sort of relationship with Russia that the EU had with Russia. So, you know, American sanctions against Russia would never really, in economic terms, have that much of an impact. But the European sanctions, because of the vacant consensual nature in which they were negotiated, you know, they end up as or at least at the start, back in 2014, a fairly lowest common denominator of things that all of the European member states could agree, with carve-outs here and there for, you know, Slovenian banks and, you know, French helicopter kind of, that wasn't a carve-out, the French eventually caved on sort of reneging on that contract with the Russians, you know, the kind of the carrier deal and that sort of thing. Lots of kind of carve-outs, you know, we wouldn't do SWIFT, and believe me, SWIFT was one of the things on the table at the time, but that was seen as too much of a nuclear option. So the lowest common denominator of EU sanctions, you know, weakens their impact. You know, that would be the first thing. The second thing would be that there are always kind of bigger economic shocks, exogenous economic shocks coming along anyway So there were two oil price collapses during the period that I was in Russia at the end of 2014 and the start of 2016. You know, these shocks were far bigger, you know, on the Russian economy than the impact of the sanctions themselves. And, you know, estimates vary, but, you know, I'll be talking to the IMF and the World Bank and other people, economists on the Russian side as well. You know, at best, sanctions accounted for 10 to 30% of the impact on the Russia's economy from, you know, compared to the impact of the oil price shocks themselves. That's one thing. Then you fast forward to kind of COVID before this all kicks off, and that's even worse still. So by that time, you know, the sanctions impact is fairly low compared to the impact of these other bigger economic shocks that are happening on Russia. And the third, I think, critically, is that kind of Russia actually has a very kind of smart and very competent macroeconomic sort of policy-making machine, despite the, you know, the influence of the Siloviki and other bits of how the country is run, how the kind of the heights of the economy are run in terms of the central banking policy, kind of fiscal policy and so on, has been very, very stable and very kind of well managed by Elvira Nabiullina and Anton Siluanov, you know, the finance minister. And so they've had that kind of consistency in economic decision-making throughout that time, which has allowed them to kind of manage the economic shocks of, you know, the sanctions, fairly small effect, oil price collapses, COVID, much bigger effects, which has led to kind of a gradual, I mean, people talk about the militarization of the Russian economy today. Actually, the Russian economy structurally has been adapting really since 2015. And that's largely down to kind of handling of kind of the, you know, Nabiullina and Siluanov in particular. So, you know, when we get to, you know, war starting in February 2022, you know, quite stringent sort of additional sanctions were imposed, but you're very quickly hitting sort of diminishing marginal returns in terms of the economic impact. And I think the biggest reason why sanctions haven't worked, and I'll stop after this, let you guys do some talking, you know, is that actually that, you know, that they've been seen as essentially a punitive measure. They've not been seen as something that can, you know, facilitate change in any way, particularly their conditionality and a link to the Minsk agreement, you know, no reduction of sanctions unless there's full sort of implementation of the Minsk, which is obviously, you know, patently impossible to achieve. And that has built resentment so much against sanctions that Putin will do anything possible not to comply. And you've seen this kind of quite structural pivot towards, you know, Asia, towards India as well, particularly on the back of what's happened in war. So, you know, they're not affecting change. They're not having sufficient economic impact. And they're not actually kind of facilitating any resolution of the fundamental reason that they exist or they're put in place, which is a conflict in Ukraine where, you know, our permissive attitude towards the Ukrainian government has meant that, you know, there's no incentive for them to comply on their side.
If I could just come in, because this is exactly where you were at the centre of it, because you were there at the embassy and you were at the economics section and you were basically the person who was discussing sanctions, and you were trying to get London, you're trying to get London to understand this. And by the way, you're the only person, the only person I've seen in Britain who seems to have understood the ruble issue properly, that, you know, the fall of the ruble when oil prices fall is not a sign of a collapse. It is a sign of the economy adjusting. And this is something that I've also tried to explain to many people in the last 10 years or so. And I've always failed, by the way. Every time the ruble falls a few points, this is a sign of collapse. It's not. But it seems you were having the same problem with the people you were reporting back to in London. They didn't seem to understand that the sanctions were not achieving whatever objective they were supposed to be achieving, and that the Russian economy was gradually shifting in a way that would make them less effective. Again, am I right in this? There just isn't a sense.
Absolutely right. In fact, Russia explicitly moved to a weak ruble policy. So when after war started, the ruble absolutely collapsed. Russia made enormous profits from its exports of mineral resources in that first period. They made a huge kind of current account surplus, you know, far more exports than imports. And so, yeah, that you know, this kind of talks to a basic two things, really. A basic lack of economic literacy in the Foreign Office itself in the UK. People, if you work in as a British diplomat, you're interested in sexy politics. Politics is a thing that floats people's boats because you can waffle on all day about politics and you know, busk to your heart's content, and you'll have somebody who's willing to kind of listen to you. You know, when you talk about economics, you need to actually to be thinking about hard data and analysis and trends and shifts, you know, and that sort of thing. And there's much less appetite for that, firstly, because it's not political, it's not as fun as politics. And people just don't have the training to engage with that anyway. I mean, you know, diplomats don't generally join as economists. They join because they want to be diplomats, right? That's one thing. And secondly, ministers are just not interested. You know, sanctions are seen as an end in themselves. You know, a decade down the track now, you know, when Liz Truss, you know, was Foreign Secretary, she just wanted to sanction anybody. She wasn't really interested in, you know, the impact of the sanctions. Her main priority was that the UK, and therefore she, be seen as the most active in adding new sanctions on Russia than anybody else in the European and also, you know, the US kind of grouping. I mean, that was her main kind of concern. But there were slight chinks in that because, you know, what's interesting about the sanctions introduced after the war started was the people in the UK who weren't sanctioned. You know, so the choices about who got sanctioned was very, very political. So, you know, Yelena Baturina, you know, the former mayor of Moscow, you know, formerly considered the most corrupt woman in Russia, she's never been sanctioned. Mikhail Khodorkovsky has never been sanctioned, and they haven't been sanctioned, well, in her case, because of her links to, you know, Sally Khan's charity in the past and Hunter Biden and Mikhail Khodorkovsky because he says what ministers want to hear. You know, so the whole reason for people being sanctioned then becomes very, very confused too and very kind of politically loaded, who we do, you know, and who we don't sanction. Yevraz, you know, the big Russian conglomerate, the reason it took so long, it took over a month to sanction them after war started, was because people were worrying about job losses in the US and Canada. You know, Yevraz had holdings there and, you know, policymakers in London were worried about, well, what are people in Washington going to think if we sanction Yevraz? You know, because that would mean some US job losses. And it becomes very, very kind of political at that stage. But, you know, people have long since forgotten to think about the economic consequences of the sanctions themselves and how this would worsen quite significantly relations with Russia.
People often forget that sanctions, of course, they're supposed to have a you know, economic pressure for political to change political policies, but this is not exclusive to Britain, though. This idea that sanctions becomes an end on its own, that instead of trying to force policy shift, it's merely creating economic pain becomes an objective in itself. And I think one of the things that made this even more disastrous was that after the toppling of Yanukovych with the backing of the West in 2014, the Russian made an very determined effort to shift their economy from this goal of, you know, integrating with greater Europe, and instead went east to this greater Eurasia. So
Successfully so, I would say.
Yeah, very much so. But then these sanctions, a key problem of sanctions is often, as you know, history taught us, if you push them too hard, the country is sanctioned merely learns to live without the belligerent. And at this point in time in history, when you have this huge East opening up, which is strong and dynamic, that it wasn't calculated how much pain, how huge changes they also had by having Russia effectively move its economy from being Western-centric to pursuing this greater Eurasia. I was just wondering, were there debates within or discussions within the British diplomatic service about the possible negative consequences? In other words, to what extent this would undermine Britain and the West's own economic interests and security?
Yeah, not in any substantive way, I'd say. I just don't think people really cared that much. That's far too much detail. I mean, you know, people worried about the kind of Russia-Sino kind of tilt. I think more because of what that means in the South China Sea, I think, you know, more than economically, I would argue. But also, actually, you know, what people don't understand is that kind of Russia's tilt to the east is also partly political in terms of the growth of the BRICS grouping, You know, bear in mind there, and Putin has said this himself, that you know, BRICS is partly about balancing the tensions between Russia, India, and China. It isn't just about kind of Russia, China. It's about China, India. It's about sort of Russia, India, and Russia, China as well. I don't think really people were thinking about that. And of course, now we see BRICS Plus, where BRICS is now, you know, now Russia's out of the G8. BRICS is very much seen as a vehicle to kind of generate political discussion about kind of issues in the global south. I think the BRICS grouping is really kind of taking the lead in terms of that whole agenda, this kind of what some people call this kind of shift to the multipolar world idea. That's very much, I would argue, being driven in a significant way by the emergence of, or the greater importance of BRICS as grouping on the back of what happened in Ukraine in 2014.
Does anybody ever discuss in Britain the opportunities that Russia might have presented? Because this is the other thing that I never see anywhere in your book, that you talk about the lack of strategic thinking, the lack of the sense of drift, because it does seem to be, as a, more than anything else, there is a kind of drift. Philip Hammond, a foreign secretary that you are particularly critical of, you'd have expected that he would understand something about economics after he ceased to be foreign secretary, became chancellor after all. And he was an accountant, I understand. You'd have thought he would understand some of these things and about how markets work and exchange rates work. He doesn't seem to have been really interested. He doesn't seem to have liked, that's my impression, he didn't like the Russians very much. Am I wrong here? Theresa May, the same. She doesn't seem to have really liked the Russians, wanted to engage with them. And yet you have this huge country, enormous resources, lacking at that time investment capital, which is what we are in Britain particularly good at. I mean, yeah.
And that we're dependent on, actually.
And we're dependent on. I mean, this was a huge opportunity, I would have thought. And we never built it. And you talk much in your book about, you know, we could have worked to build economic relationships, and in time that might have also led to a successful political relationship as well. But I got the sense throughout the book that just people in London weren't paying the kind of attention that they should and weren't thinking about it properly.
Yeah, I mean, I think Philip Hammond made a better chancellor than he made a foreign secretary, but it's just a personal view of mine. And he was very, very hawkish on Russia. You're absolutely right. There's a hardball determination just not to engage at a political level with Sergei Lavrov. As diplomats and as statespeople, you know, foreign secretary is our biggest statesperson, I suppose, short of, you know, the monarch and the prime minister. You know, it's not about liking people, it's about how to kind of craft a relationship with them. It doesn't really matter if you like or don't like the person you're dealing with. The challenge is how can you build a relationship with that country, with that sort of opposite number, to de-conflict, but also to talk about areas of mutually beneficial cooperation that can bounce off, you know, the difficulties and the tensions that exist in the relationship. And of course, all this was happening against a backdrop of the UK kind of stumbling towards an EU referendum, and the whole, even though the EU gets very distracted by its own internal kind of machinations these days, the whole basis of the peace settlement in Europe after the Second World War was this gradual kind of economic integration between previously kind of warring states. You know, the kind of four freedoms. No, people don't like to talk about these things, particularly in the UK. But that commerce as a vehicle towards peace was vital in a way that it could have been really helpful with Russia as well. But I think, you know, there are two types of kind of people with a view on you know, the UK's relationship with Russia. There are those who think that politics should come first. You know, we should only engage politically with the country. We should only engage economically with the country when politically, you know, we find some sort of common understanding with them. And clearly there was none. And therefore, you know, why should we engage economically with a country that we disagree with so deeply as we do with Russia? And those like me who see kind of economics and commerce as a vehicle towards greater kind of peace and mutual understanding. And that's a view that's become, you know, increasingly unpopular, particularly in the European family now, as they're intent on sort of having some sort of full-blown war with with Russia, it seems. But Hammond, as a statesperson, was very much on the politics first. You know, we don't agree with Russian action, therefore, there's no benefit in talking about some economic future, you know, with Russia as a kind of as a route towards peace. And I think that's one of the big challenges we face there.
I wanted to follow up on something Alexander mentioned. Well, actually, you discussed earlier as well. You mentioned there was no clear strategy. I think you called the foreign policy being lazy, or at least being on autopilot. And I was just curious, because I want to quote a great British, which is John Stuart Mill. I found this quote from him from 1836, when he wrote about the British military budgets being out of control. And he wrote that, quote, "Ministers are smitten with the epidemic disease of Russophobia." And 2 years later, in 1838, you had the Chronicle, who called for a more rational approach, in which it wrote, "Let Russia be watched, and when detected in hostility towards us, let us retaliate, but let not a great nation make itself ridiculous by an insane Russophobia." So I guess with Russophobia, it's referring to irrational fear. Now, I'm not saying that there's no competing interests between the British and the Russians, or there's no reason to criticize Russia or no reason to fear Russia. But over the past 200 years, there's often been this argument that there's often been the competition hasn't only been influenced by rationality, but there's also been some instinctive or irrational component. Do you see any of this today? Of course, it's 200 years
ago. There's certainly a high level of mutual distrust, and which has only gotten worse, and is now in just a complete disastrous kind of state between our two countries, because it works both ways. You know, relationships are back on two parties after all. But I think you know, we've made ourselves most ridiculous by sitting in this kind of policy no man's land between wanting war and wanting peace. And I've said this kind of maybe alluded to a bit in the book that, you know, we haven't wanted to kind of go to war with Russia in Ukraine. I'm happy to kind of sponsor the proxy war in Ukraine, but we don't actually want an all-out war, you know, despite what sort of policymakers in sort of Paris may say at the moment. But neither have we wanted to live in peace with Russia. You know, we haven't really wanted to have kind of a better relationship, not necessarily a happy relationship, not necessarily a loving relationship, but a relationship in which we can live in peace without trying to kind of impact Russia's internal political settlement and all these kind of things that we get easily distracted by. And in the middle of that, you've got Ukraine that is suffering from this, you know, and I think we're right from the start, we needed to make that kind of fairly binary, I have to say, because I think this is something that the Russians understand quite well. You know, do we want a peaceful relationship, a peaceful way out of this conflict, which frankly we've helped to kind of create through what happened in February 2014? Or do we want to go to war with Russia and have an end to it, and then we'll all be damned and probably nuked in the process? And I think it's that inability to kind of focus on what we want in Ukraine, and what we want in terms of our relationship with Russia, which has kind of crippled us and made us ridiculous.
I just want to turn on that to the issue of the Foreign Office and the state of the Foreign Office. And there were some things that, frankly, I found very disturbing. I found it astonishing, for example, that at our embassy in Moscow, there were so few people with the highest qualifications in Russian. Now, I assumed that anybody who got posted to the embassy in Moscow would have at least a degree level Russian, but it turns out not. We apparently have an increasingly thin training and preparation of diplomats that we send to these places, especially to Russia, where you would definitely need to have pretty strong diplomats, I would have thought. As far as I can understand, this isn't just Russia. This is a general problem across the entire Foreign Office system, that we are giving far less emphasis to diplomacy than we ought to be, which is very strange at a time when we've gone from being a superpower, which is what we were, you know, 60, 70, 100 years ago, to becoming a middle-ranking, still important state. A country like that would need diplomacy even more, one would have thought, than, you know, a great power used to do. but it is going in the wrong direction. And again, any explanation for this? I mean, why is this happening? Is it because ministers, the political system aren't interested in this? You talk about the very large number, the incredibly high turnover of ministers that you have to cope, you had to cope with.
I think there are two reasons for that. Firstly, the ministers just don't care about diplomacy, which is essentially about kind of getting out and understanding the country that you're in so that you can give good advice, you know, through diplomatic kind of communications to your ministers. I mean, that's the base of it. We don't do it just for the fun of it. You know, you learn Russian so that you can get out into Russian, into the country, meet ordinary Russian people, meet decision makers in Russia, and get a sense of what they think about trends in UK-Russia relations, about sanctions, about, you know, where the country's headed, the internal political situation, that sort of thing. It gives you that entry point to kind of build relationships and build understanding so that we can advise ministers kind of well. When ministers already have their mindset set on what the policy should be, then the need for people like me who kind of invested in their kind of diplomatic training and spend the time outside of the embassy building, kind of meeting Russian people, kind of falls away. So there's that, you know, quite an important sort of strategic reason why. And secondly, the Foreign Office just doesn't really do well enough at holding officers to account and making sure it sends people out with the right skills. You know, we've had so many changes of ministers. I mean, William Hague was quite good on this, and then we got Philip Hammond, and, you know, my views on him. You know, Dominic Raab came in, he wanted to turn the Foreign Office into a sort of version of Boston Consulting group. We're all kind of trained in Excel spreadsheets and that sort of thing, very little focus. Jeremy Hunt was quite good on languages, but we saw him as a kind of a journeyman because Theresa May's government was in going through a long and slow kind of death at the time. So he wanted to double language use, but then, you know, the organisation knew that he'd be going anyway and didn't do anything on that. The organisation has become lazy in ensuring that, you know, officers have the skills that they need, particularly language skills. And that situation is going backwards. Just seen today information from the Foreign Office saying that, you know, of all the kind of people that we train in foreign languages every year, over 30% just never hit their qualifications in the language. So this is all languages, you know, around the world. And I'm quite sure that for Russian, it's much lower than that, actually, the number of people who pass. And that's like several million pounds a year in officers' training that just goes completely out of the window. So that kind of, there's laziness on the Foreign Office's part that it's never really kind of gripped this issue.
I find it interesting decline of the diplomacy, because it seems to be the whole diplomatic culture appears to have changed. We seem to treat often diplomacy as bestowing legitimacy on someone. This is not only just in 2014, we saw the same back in 2008 when the Russians had the conflict with Georgia. Yeah. As soon as there's actually conflict and we need diplomacy the most, we see a complete cutoff. Yeah. And this is also what we saw from Philip Hammond when he just decided to cut all high-level dialogue with Russia in 2014 at the very point when you need the diplomacy the most. How do you see this as a diplomat? Is this, have we changed diplomacy, which used to be about harmonizing interests, managing competing interests, and until effective being some kind of reward system for working with people we already agree with? Because there's this often sense that diplomats don't do diplomacy anymore, which is it's a strange development.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a well-formed sense, I have to say. In fact, I'll say that is a very accurate portrayal of the way things are kind of these days. Partly it's been, I mean, in the past, there's always kind of a healthy tension between the embassies and London. You know, policymakers in London will pull their hair out that the embassy wanted to take a slightly kind of more nuanced line on this or that country about this or that kind of issue. But that was healthy because, you know, good advice was being sent up and, you know, ministers were receptive to kind of differences of thought and ideas as long as it's rooted in kind of evidence, you know, from the ground. So you always had the kind of healthy tension. That's gone away. I think these days, if you're a senior sort of diplomat and you're saying something that the minister doesn't want to hear, then it can be very career limiting, and because, you know, diplomats by the nature, very consensual sort of middle ground type of folk. And if you're, say, take a really good example, if you're the ambassador in Spain, you know, and you're taking a view on sort of issues around sort of EU, you know, policy that's different from what the foreign secretary, you know, is taking, this Dominic Raab at the time is in all the newspapers, you can look it up, then, you know, you could be called out. You could have Jake Rees-Mogg tweeting you a complete prat or whatever words he used. And, you know, no senior diplomats don't want to take that risk. And therefore, there's that kind of, you know, elastic, big elastic band pulling them towards saying what the ministers want to hear.
There are some, actually, in some ways, rather sad moments, because you talk about the embassy being essentially a Potemkin embassy, and it becomes more so this time. I mean, the first ambassador you had seems to have been a real diplomat who had, I mean, he had his eccentricities, I suppose, but he seems to have been somebody who was, you know, did diplomacy. But over time, one senses that the embassy essentially turns in on itself and becomes less active and comes under more and more pressure with expulsions and other things. Then you go to St. Petersburg and you find the consulate there doing lots of things that the embassy in Moscow isn't doing. And then you go to the embassy in Beijing and you find the embassy there is also doing lots of things that the Moscow embassy isn't doing. And is there something specific about the Moscow embassy, the Moscow posting, that it just isn't getting the energy or hasn't had the energy that it needed to have in order to function properly? Because there's one particular point in your book where it seems there's only, I mean, perhaps you won't like what I'm going to say, but there seem to be only two people who are actually doing things. One is yourself, and the other is a person who actually does speak Russian and learns to figure skate and discovers that that's a way of making friends. So, I mean, is there something about the kind of people who get posted to Moscow that gradually is eroding the embassy away?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say there are two things on that. I mean, you know, one is fear. You know, before you got a posting to Moscow, you know, you have all these briefings where people tell you about honey traps and all the kind of devilish things that may happen to you when you get there. And so people arrive in a kind of state of fear that all these awful things, you know, people are going to poo in your toilets when you're out at work all day and that sort of thing. So people live in this kind of creation of a Jean Le Carré novel, where it's also desperately kind of worrying, the only difference being that they don't want to go out and engage in that context. And of course, the reality is different. I mean, yeah, harassment exists, but it never limited me in any way. I didn't find me. That's a weird and wonderful things happened to me. But for a lot of people, it just forces them to stay in the building. Of course, that's a victory for Russia too, right? Because, you know, that if they're limiting our ability to act, then that's a victory for them too. So there's a, you know, fear is a big part of that. And, you know, I never found that in the embassy in Beijing. It's fascinating. And it's the same sort of high threat type of place, equally as high threat a place, you know, as a British diplomat, as Moscow. And yet people were just going out and enjoying life, I mean, doing the work, difficult work at times, but still having a fairly normal life outside of being inside of the Chancery, kind of secure walls of the Chancery and so on. That felt really kind of different, and I never really understood why, but I thought it was kind of fear. We kind of whip up this idea that it's kind of this really high-threat place, and it's not that much, frankly, I have to say. I mean, there are threats, but you can imagine risks, you know, and so on. Beijing was never like that. That's one. The second is like a culture. You know, as we've disinvested in skills, language skills, but also diplomatic skills, everybody wants to be doing policy, whatever that means. Everybody wants to be talking to the London mothership about the latest thing they've kind of put through Google Translate from a, you know, a Russian BBC monitoring report. I mean, they don't really want to be. Young officers, you know, with a lack of fundamental training in diplomacy, they want to be talking to the big cheeses in London about policy, even if we don't have a policy, they want to be talking to London about policy. They don't want to be out and about in, you know, out in the Urals somewhere, or down in Rostov-on-Don, talking to ornate people, because that will take them away from having FaceTime with seniors in London. And so that's a massive, massive cultural thing that is really, really hard to shift. And, you know, that was only kind of progressively getting worse in the time that I was in Moscow, it seems to me.
That reminds me, I mean, there's an extraordinary scene at the beginning of the ambassador having the people from the chancery round the table. And I have to say, it reminded me a little of some law firms I'm familiar with, where you have the partner and he's got all the associates and they're all coming up with these bright ideas, none of which really amount to anything. And there's a huge amount of activity, but nobody's actually doing anything real. And of course, going out and meeting people, and not just, you know, just ordinary people, because you met quite a lot of very interesting people when you were in Moscow, and you found that you could establish quite good relationships with them. Even people like Alex, like Kostit, the head of VTB, yeah, for example, who I know somebody who worked for Kostit, and he describes to me what an interesting and complicated man Kostit can be. But you can actually, you do actually go and meet people like that, and that gives you a sense of the country beyond this, the person in the Kremlin, Putin, who has become almost the metonym for the whole country. And this is another problem that, you know, we don't in Britain seem to understand that there are more people in Russia and more decision makers in Russia than just one. That one may be very important, but he's only one human being. And there's only 24 hours in the day. He cannot do everything, a point you make in your book.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think what's interesting about people like Kostin in particular, but others too, is if you see them in public, if you go to some economic forum up in St. Petersburg or somewhere else, and he'd be red in the face, steam coming out of his ears, smashing his fist on the table, calling out Western lackeys, trying to kind of encircle Russia, and you know, all these things. If you meet him face to face, he's much more nuanced than that, and he's much more kind of realistic about need. Actually, he's not at all Anglophone; quite the opposite. I mean, he speaks excellent English. He sort of had a posting to the Soviet embassy, sort of, you know, back in the day. You know, I always kind of sensed he wanted to kind of find a way, you know, that didn't diminish Russia in any way, but a mutually beneficial way in which we could kind of have a better relationship than we had or than we have, which is a terrible relationship. And so you always get the kind of the, I think what British media see when they see the Russian state is the kind of hard, red in the face, steam coming out of the ears, you know, smashing the fist into the table image, which just kind of works in a Russian domestic kind of political context where kind of playing to the domestic galleries, I think, kind of works quite well. If you actually engage people one to one, I always found that you get a much more nuanced, you know, perspective. People much more willing to talk as equals, you know, because they basically think that we, Russian people basically think we look down on them, but they want to have a conversation as equals about how we can together kind of find a way, navigate a way out of difficult situations. And that kind of contrast between the very public, hard at times, hard quite a lot of the time these days kind of face, and what we see in private, it was fascinating to me and actually proved to me that, you know, that dialogue can actually take you a long way if you're willing to kind of listen to their side, if you're going to get your points across about things that, you know, matter to you as well.
A lot of we actually used to work in Moscow at the same time. I was there at the Higher School of Economics, so when you were at the embassy, but the Russians I've spoken to, they always mentioned that they felt the Western diplomats were often not just British but Western overall were somewhat duplicit, because whenever they spoke to them, they, you know, laid forward this ideas that, you know, we can work on A and B, but then as soon as they went back to Brussels or wherever, then they would suddenly frame everything in a very different light. Do you see this diplomatic? Is there anything to this diplomatic language, or have you had any experience with it?
The Russian feeling that we're duplicitous. Well, yes, I mean,
or they might be as well, of course.
On a practically daily basis, particularly towards the end of my time in Moscow, I think the narrative, you know, it's hard to kind of shift the narrative sometimes, and that goes back to the point I made earlier about actually diplomatic advice not really landing in capitals in the way that it used to. You know, that tension between the embassies out in the sticks and you know, policymakers, you know, back in capitals. And I think that's very, very much true. I mean, it's very, very hard to ship the European Commission on, which was, I have to say, largely kind of trade and economics focus and sanctions focus when I was there, you know, because the sanctions line was so low as common denominator anyway to them, sort of get, you know, getting a shifted view on that. I know the EBRD, the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development, were very, very concerned about, you know, their work being limited, and it was kind of hard to shift. I guess the challenge is actually having the political leaders who kind of take a punt on actually sort of reaching out, you know, stepping away from, you know, the blob in all the capitals, including, you know, the Moscow blob too, because they have one, you know, just the same, and actually reaching out. It's only really at the level of leaders you can cut deals. You know, despite everything that we do as diplomats, ultimately, you know, if you want to find peace, you need people talking to Putin, you know, to get things done. That's the only way you're really going to get things done. And, you know, as we've moved away from dialogue, those opportunities for that kind of statesmanship have evaporated with it, to the point now where any mention of talking to Putin gets you called out as being, you know, Russia friendly or Putin friendly or something like that. But, you know, that is how statesmanship works. You know, you have to talk to leaders, especially when you have significant areas of disagreement with them.
Which is what we used to do. I mean, my memory goes back to the 1960s, and the British Foreign Secretary at the time, Alec Douglas Home, developed a very good, strong, mutually respectful relationship with Andrei Gromyko, who was the young Russian, the Soviet foreign minister of that time. And he was, by all accounts, a very difficult man. I mean, he was not an easy man to, you know, win his respect or to face across a table. But it was done. Very different people, completely different outlooks. But they did develop a relationship and a partnership. But we did diplomacy in those days. And we had a functioning embassy in Moscow also, as far as I can understand, in those days. And today we don't. And the point is, we're not isolating the Russians. We're isolating ourselves. Or so it seems to me. The Russians have now made friends in China, in India, in Vietnam, in all sorts of other places. We are increasingly finding it difficult to exert influence on world affairs, which as a trading nation, we need to do.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the biggest two moments of self-isolation for us were obviously one on the Normandy, when we kind of got flat-footed completely on that, but also Brexit itself, where, you know, we're within the European family, whatever your views on the EU membership or not, you know, we had weight within that group. We had influence within that group over decisions. I mean, we had quite a critical influence, even though I don't necessarily agree, you know, with that particular policy on sanctions. I mean, we had a lot of influence on sanctions policy. I mean, I personally think sanctions policies are failing, but the point is we had influence. But Brexit has meant that we've basically drifted towards a closer relationship with the US, where we have no influence. You know, we're just passengers, you know, in their kind of out of control roller coaster car, you know, on Russia. And I think that is the big difference for us. You know, we've lost and are losing our place, you know, in the world, and particularly in the context of trends like de-dollarization, shifting investment flows. I mean, that matters to us long term, maybe not short term, but long term in terms of London's position as a global kind of financial center and so on. You know, all these things over the much longer horizon start to be threatened, I think, by the kind of the posture that we've taken.
I'm afraid I have a hard stop, but yeah. I'm going to leave the last word to Glenn.
Yeah, no, we have to wrap it up there. No, I was just going to say, as someone who wrote, were raised on essentially watching Yes Minister, I was almost disappointed to read there was not more scheming or strategy that, as you referred to it many times as lazy. I thought that was an interesting part of the book, that it might have gone only on autopilot. So, but yes, we can leave it there unless you have some final words, Ian.
No, thanks. I mean, I think it all comes back to this critical war peace kind of, you know, tapping into Leo Tolstoy, You know, I think we need to take a choice either way, you know, whether we want peace for Ukraine in Ukraine or whether we want war with Russia. And very obviously, you know, I think a decade down the track with us being completely, you know, rooted and mired in that sort of conflict, which shows no sign of being resolved and will never be won, let's be honest, but by Ukraine, that actually we need to find a way to reintroduce statesmanship and search for peace.
I'm going to add a final word, which is I strongly advise people to read your book, Ian Proud's book, A Misfit in Moscow. It is a really actually rather astonishing picture of the way in which British diplomacy is conducted nowadays. And I think people in Britain really especially need to read it and understand and think very hard about what it says. So just wanted to say that. And thank you, by the way, Ian, for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.